خمینی امام، خمینی امام، ای مجاهد، ای مظهر شرف، ای گذشته ز جان در ره هدف. چون نجات انسان شعار توست، مرگ در راه حق.
Okay, I'm just taking these questions the way they were given to me, so don't feel, I don't know the order they came in at this, so don't hold me responsible for that. The first one here in front of me says, how do you explain, quote unquote, Muslims who want to be like that white man in the elevator? This is of course in reference to the example I gave in the presentation. Okay. Once again, how do you explain, quote unquote, Muslims who want to be like that white man in the elevator in order to influence public opinion about Muslims? Well, you know, these types are, first of all, I don't think they know who they are, and they are beholden to those who are in possession of worldly facilities, and they've lost track of their Islamic principles. A Muslim does not want to be like anyone else except who he or she is. If they want to try to imitate someone else or act like someone else, or, you know, then they become eventually that someone else. And no rituals should camouflage them. The problem, this brings up, it infers another issue, and that is many of us, we define Muslims by rituals. This is one of the historical baggages or loads that we carry with us. We are not defined by rituals. Rituals obviously are part of who we are, but they're just that, part of who we are. They are not who we are or who we should be. They are not. When Allah, the Quran is the best reference of this. When He speaks about people losing their identity, they don't lose their identity because they no longer practice their rituals. Bani Israel didn't lose its way because they didn't practice their rituals. They were intensely practicing their rituals, but they were not loyal to the social justice issues that Allah entrusted them with. So they lost their identity. And we are not an exception to the rule. If we don't carry our social justice responsibilities, we are no longer Muslims. You can perform thousands of rak'at every day. You can fast 300 days a year. You can go to the Hajj every year and the Umrah in addition to that. But that does not make you the person who you're supposed to be. And then the second question here says, how do mustadhafeen protect themselves from being oppressive when they rise to power? this takes a book to answer. How, you know, power corrupts, and some individuals when they reach the positions of power, they begin to corrupt themselves. I mentioned this in the khutbah just yesterday. Western philosopher says something like, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The ayah in the Quran says, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَيَطْغَى أَرَّآهُ اسْتَغْنَى. It's human nature. People who reach the position of what they consider to be self-centered power and no need of the other, then they begin to abuse this power. The power they have is manipulated in a monopolized way, and corruption begins there. One of the features of the late Imam and the current Imam One of their features, they're not corrupted by power. You can notice, I leave this up to your acumen and your insight, you can notice some individuals when they have power, something, before they gained power, they were, you know, very nice, very acceptable. But when they began to exercise this power, something happened. Something happened to them. This type of power got to them. So they began to, in a certain way, misbehave. So, I think people who are assigned positions of power should be scrutinized. And I think if we look at the Islamic Republic of Iran, I think they are very conscious of this, and that's what they are doing. Another question says, please explain the concept of wilayat al-faqih and compare it with the Sunni concept of political leadership. You want me to stay here for another hour? Wilayat al-faqih simply means the allegiance authority that belongs to the qualified Islamic scholar. That's as simple as it gets. And what is dynamic about this concept is that Imam al-Khomeini, may Allah's blessings be his forever, he regenerated the political responsibilities of the Muslims at a time when they went dormant, in particular those who belong to the Shi'i persuasion. They sort of felt that in the absence of the 12th Imam, political responsibilities at the level of al-wilaya or al-imama, they should be left up to the advent of the 12th Imam, not to the qualified Islamic scholar. Wilayat al-faqih is a revolutionary concept in the sense that it galvanized these hitherto politically inactive Muslims to assume their Islamic responsibilities and say, I don't want to borrow this phrase, but it just came to my mind, yes, we can. So they assumed that responsibility. Imam al-Khomeini was the first one to assume that responsibility, and after him, Imam al-Khamenei. Now, the second part of this question is compare it with the Sunni concept of political leadership. There's not really very much written in the Sunni library about the Islamic political leadership. There's a lot of other books written about a lot of other subjects, but this particular one, you'll find very few books on this subject. To put it in a few words, the divergence between the concept of wilayat al-faqih and the general, because Sunnis also here break down into different definitions, but generally speaking, their concept of a leader is contingent upon and exclusively upon what is referred to in Western social sciences as a social contract, which more or less means that the leader in the Islamic domain needs by necessity to have the approval of whatever population base that leader is located in. But it's, you know, there are terms in some Sunni books that, I'll give you one of those terms called Ahl al-Hal wal-Aqd. This more or less means legislators. Al-Hal wal-Aqd is to legislate certain policies and then to unlegislate certain other policies. Not laws. The laws are there in the Sharia. Everyone knows them. You can't do that. But there are procedures and policies that go with Shara'i law, and they tell us, these some of these writers, as scarce as they are, who write about this issue, that Ahl al-Hal wal-Aqd are the ones who are more or less entrusted with finalizing the process of a legitimate Islamic leader. But I want to say here, before I go on to another question, you know, in the Qur'an, I've been working, I thank the introducer, the moderator, for mentioning that I've been working on a tafsir of the meanings of the Holy Qur'an in the English language. I humbly say that this is the first tafsir that's written in the English language about the meanings of the Noble Qur'an. And I found out, I've been doing this for about 13, 14 years now, I found out that there's not enough information. Look, in the Qur'an there are Qur'anic terms. The first one is wilaya, walaya. Walaya is a Qur'anic word. It is mentioned in the Qur'an in different surahs. Another word in the Qur'an is hukm, which is also another Qur'anic term. It's another Qur'anic, fits in the Qur'anic vocabulary, mentioned in different surahs of the Qur'an. But here I am, I'm trying, because the English language, this is a language I'm working on, to bring the meanings of the Qur'an into the English language, because life here is refined to such a degree that you can't generalize. You have to be a little more precise about words. And here's where I realize that we Muslims have not done enough thought as to accurately discern wilaya from hukm. It hasn't been done. I'm sorry to say, I mean, I'm not trying here to, you know, break new grounds and, you know, say, tell you something, but it's just something that I've come across and I observed. We haven't had enough discriminating information, discerning information. These are two different words. And the ayat in the Qur'an are obvious. هُنَالِكَ الْوَلَايَةُ لِلَّهِ الْحَقِّ وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. And the other one, أَفَحُكْمَ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ يَبْغُونَ وَمَنْ أَحْسَنُ مِنَ اللَّهِ حُكْمًا لِقَوْمٍ يُوقِنُونَ أَحْكَمُ الْحَاكِمِينَ أَنِحْكُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ. Anyways, it goes on and on. So this area still has to be developed. I can go on, but you know, obviously I have more questions here. There's another question here. It says, many say that the Wahhabis / Saudis are the problem, not America or Israel. What evidence supports the contrary? I think this is, in a sense, a rhetorical question, because the Wahhabis, Saudis, and the Zionists and imperialists, all of them form one body. One of them cannot function without the other. So when you try to come and say, you know, who is responsible, they have roles that they play. Saudi Arabia can do things Israel and the United States can't do. So it's necessary for it to do those things so the Washington, Tel Aviv will have it their way. Tel Aviv can do things something Saudi Arabia can't do. So it's necessary for Tel Aviv to do those things. Saudi Arabia can play havoc in the internal psychology of Muslims. The Washingtonians and the Tel Avivians can't do that. The Israelis can drop bombs on Muslims. The Saudi Arabians, if they want to do that, they'll be committing political suicide. So they have to help themselves out in that regard. Can we see it like that? And if we do, you know, we've come a long way there. I am told that I'm supposed to end at 8:30. I have about, and my watch tells me 1 minute. I don't know what I can answer here in 1 minute. Maybe the shortest question I find in front of me. Maybe this one, even though this can take another half hour, but it's the shortest one I have in front of me. It says, what do you predict about the situation in Syria now? With a minute left, the situation in, well, that clock over there gives me 2 minutes. The situation in Syria is, it's very unpredictable. They want me to predict here. I'll tell you, it's very unpredictable. Unpredictable in the near future. A lot of things can happen this year and next year. It's very fluid. And so, oh, thank you very much. A generosity, someone chipped in 10 more minutes. Thank you. Okay. Gives me a little more comfort here in answering this question. The issue in Syria, I don't know if I, because I mentioned these things at different venues and I can't, I was here last year, I don't even know. I think the Syrian issue was also on everyone's mind at that time. But many times I summarize the Syrian issue like this, and everyone gets, you know, upset with me when I say this. Well, mostly everyone. Some of them really understand, they appreciate this summarization. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was asked about the Khawarij who broke away from him, who were referred to in another hadith as al-Mariqeen, when they came out and said, La hukma illa lillah. You see, when we speak about hukm here, they didn't say La walaya illa lillah. They said La hukma illa lillah. So some people listening to this came to the Imam and asked him, what do you say about this? They're saying, you, Muawiyah and Amr ibn al-As, you have to go because all of you are claiming this position. This position only belongs to Allah. So he said, it's a very eloquent answer to their question. كَلِمَةُ حَقْ يُرَادُ بِهَا بَاطِلٌ. The words are true, but the intentions concealed in these words are false, is false. The intention is false, even though the words are true. And to take that same statement and to place it in the Syrian context, there are two things I think no one should have, before I break this down for you, there's two things no one should have any doubt about. Because if you do, I think your emotions are playing with you at the expense of your rational self. The first issue is, should be no doubt in the world that the number one enemy of the Israelis is Hezbollah and the Islamic leadership in Iran. Number one, and no one in their right mind should have any question about this. Because this plays into what's happening in Syria. The other issue that no one should have any doubt about in their mind is that the Syrian people do not have a representative government. I know this places me in a hard position because the Ba'ath Party in Syria, if you're following what's happening there, the Israelis and the Americans and their Arabian extensions, they've been saying in the past 2+ years that they will accept Ba'ath rulers to Syria, meaning persons like Farouk al-Sharra or some other individual, that's the vice president, or some other individual belonging to the Ba'ath party. They had no problems with that. So what's their problem? They're not looking out for the Syrian people. What they are looking out for is they want to dislodge the faction of the Syrian government that has maintained a principled position vis-a-vis the overall strategy of liberating Palestine. That's why they tell you Bashar al-Assad has to go. Well, what's wrong? Bashar al-Assad, why does he have to go? Why doesn't the whole Ba'ath system have to go from Syria? They never say that. If you tune in, pay close attention to what they are saying. They never tell you that the Ba'ath government in Syria has to go. They always say Bashar has to go. Those who claim that they represent the Syrian people, i.e. the opposition, voices in Washington, in European capitals, and in Tel Aviv, all of them say Bashar al-Assad has to go. Now you ask yourself, why are they saying Bashar? So they're not concerned with whether the Syrian people are represented or not. They say that for propagandistic purposes. They want to sell their strategy. So they say, oh, they feel sorry for the Syrian people. You feel sorry for the Syrian people? Oh, yeah? Then why are you arming the Israelis with everything that they want, who are using all of the weapons that they have against what the Syrian people stand for? And with the internal differences among the Syrian people, with right now the exception of a lunatic, crazy political fringe who sold its soul to the devil in Washington and Tel Aviv, with their exception, all the Syrian people are against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The issue is here that the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, was offered a lot of things in these past years. It's been going on for 10+ years. He was approached by the Americans, by the Europeans, by the Israelis. Not him personally. His representatives met with some Israelis in Europe, in Turkey, in Qumran, in Cyprus, and other places. And what did they want? They weren't looking for the rights of the Syrian people. They didn't care about it. They weren't saying, you know, we want the Syrian people to have a representative government, like they're saying right now for propaganda purposes. No, they weren't saying that. What they were saying to them in these meetings, secret meetings, is we want you to break your strategic relationship with Tehran. That's what we want you to do. And if you do that, your economy is going to flourish. And we will reach some type of understanding about the Golan Heights, maybe demilitarizing the Golan Heights. We will assure you and yours a continuation of unending political future. Only thing we want you to do is sever relations with Tehran. And that's what he didn't do. He could have done, if this person was looking for a quick way out of this, if he wasn't principled in his position with the policy to liberate Palestine emanating from the Islamic Republic, if he wanted to do something like that, he could have easily said, oh yeah, I'm going to go along with your plans. In his company, in his Ba'athi company, others wanted that option. They said, let's take it. Let's go with the Europeans, the Americans, and then obviously with the Israelis, because look at what we're going to get in exchange for that. You know, they were being fooled, but they didn't know that they were being fooled. And he wasn't being fooled. So, you know, they have him as a target. He has to go. So, here's how we have it. To go back to an Imam's statement, kalimatu haqqi wa batil. The revolt in Syria is a legitimate revolt, meaning that in its origins, it was asking, this is before the troublemakers came on the line and they began this internal civil war. The people themselves, all they were asking for is a representative government. So the initial steps were valid. There's nothing wrong with people asking for representative. No one can fault any people in the world for asking for a representative government. But the intention behind this is false. ثورة حق يراد بها باطل. You understand? And then on the other hand, the Syrian government, the government itself, we're not talking about factions within the ruling party, we're not talking about the president's steadfastness in his policies with the Islamic Republic to liberate Palestine, the support to Hezbollah, etc. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the government as it sits with its own people. It is حكومة باطل يراد بها حق. This is an invalid government by any, however way you want to look at it. If you're just looking, forget about the Syrian policies towards the Islamic Republic, towards the occupation of Palestine. Forget about its external policies. Strictly internally speaking, it's an invalid government. But the intention behind this invalid government is to it's an intention of haq, to liberate Palestine. And many Muslims got strewn across this line. They just couldn't see the full spectrum. Some of them are caught in one part of the equation. The others are caught in the opposite part of the equation. And only a few could see the whole picture in a healthy and in a wholesome way. And this more or less character. And in the middle of all of this, the Syrian people now who are suffering the consequences. You know, the Syrian people, they were, in a sense, very hospitable to their neighbors. When there were problems in Lebanon, the Lebanese fled to Syria. No one ever heard of Lebanese camps in Syria. When the Palestinians had problems, they fled to Syria. Some very high-ranking Syrian officials in the government are Palestinian, of Palestinian origin. They weren't discriminated against. When the Iraqis had problems in Iraq and they crossed the borders into Syria, they didn't live in refugee camps. They were met with hospitality inside Syrian homes and families. Now the Syrian people themselves are forced into refugee status, and we find them in the hundreds of thousands in refugee camps in Turkey, in Jordan, in Lebanon. 1.5 million of them externally displaced. They had to flee the country altogether. Inside of Syria, around 4 to 4.5 million people are displaced inside their own country. They had to leave one city or one town to another city and another town. This is a tragedy, what is happening. And in the middle of this, to be honest, we're not here trying to play politics. We're trying to be honest. The way that the Imam's way. The Syrian people don't have representatives. These people who say that they are the opposition and they are the rebels and they are the revolutionaries and etc., etc., they don't represent the Syrian people. One of these characters came to Washington. He's in Washington, D.C. He left Syria in the early 1980s. And he went to the Israeli parliament and he said, "We have no problems if we come to power with having normal relations between Damascus and Tel Aviv." These types of figures, they don't represent the Syrian people. So this so-called Free Syrian Army, the National Syrian Council, the guys that meet in Geneva and some European capital, in Paris, in Istanbul, in Qatar, Doha, in Cairo, in these captives, they don't represent the Syrian. These are armchair revolutionaries. They're getting paid $5 billion in the past 2 years have been paid to these people. What do they do with this money? There's some people making a lot of money out of this, out of the misery of their own people. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I have much more questions here in front of me. I beg your pardon for not having the time to answer them all. Thank you very much for your presence and your patience. Wassalamu wa rahmatuhu wa barakatuhu alaykum.